everybody, this is Kelly. Just wanted to kind of check in with y'all and hope y'all are, you know, staying safe and practicing good social distancing and proper hand washing and not leaving, you know, your house unless you absolutely need to. And those that are, you know, sick or being affected by this, my heart goes out to you. So we're, you know, we're recording separately, or I'm recording separately, so that way I can kind of keep my family and myself safe. And this new episode, I'm super excited about it. It's taken me 2 weeks worth of intense research, and I'm so excited. I finally got it all done, and I'm ready to record it and put it out for you guys. So without much, you know, much more further ado, I'm gonna get started. This week I am doing Ted Bundy. There's been so many new documentaries and stuff out, and there was just so much different research that I had to sift through, and I got my resources from biography.com, thoughtco.com, ABC News, thecharlieproject.org, Murderpedia, and by watching Ted Bundy, Falling for a Killer. If you haven't seen that, it's on Amazon Prime. I highly, highly recommend it because it had so many different interviews with Liz Kendall and her daughter Molly, who Liz was Ted's girlfriend through 90% of his murdering, and Molly was her daughter. And it's got interviews with the victims' families and those that were closest to him. And it was intense, and I highly, highly recommend it. It was, seriously, oh my gosh, I loved it. So, Theodore Robert Bundy was born on November 24th, 1946 in Burlington, Vermont. While there's speculation of who Ted's father was, there's no concrete proof on that part of his history. His mother, Eleanor Louise Cowell, was just 22 years old and unmarried when he was born, which was considered a shame of her family in those times. Due to the family's deep religious background, Eleanor was sent to deliver in a home for unwed mothers before giving Ted to her parents in Philadelphia to be raised as their adopted son. This meant that for the first 14 years of Ted's life, he grew up believing that Eleanor was his sister, though he did say that he before it was confirmed, he always questioned it. A few years later, she took him with her to Tacoma, Washington, where she met and later married Ted's stepfather, Johnny Bundy. At 14 years old, Ted found his birth certificate, giving him concrete proof that Eleanor was indeed his mother. To the outside world, Ted's early childhood in Philadelphia was great and uneventful. However, his grandmother suffered from depression and agoraphobia, which is an intense fear of open spaces. It's a lot of times when people with agoraphobia are too scared to leave their home. His grandfather had an explosive temper. It was said that he would often fly off the handle easily and was both physically and verbally abusive to everybody, including his own employees and animals. Though Eleanor swore up and down that she was seduced by a war veteran, experts theorized that Ted was actually a product of rape at the hands of his grandfather. Bundy's obsession with knives started when he was just 3 years old. In one interview, Bundy's aunt woke up on multiple occasions to the toddler placing knives around her body. She said, "I remember thinking at the time that I was the only one who thought it was strange. Nobody did anything." Though Ted swore that he and his grandfather had a good relationship, expert psychologist Dr. Dorothy Lewis said that those actions occur only in very seriously traumatized children who have either themselves been victims of extraordinary abuse or have witnessed extreme violence among family members. A few years later, Eleanor, still raising Ted to believe that she was his sister, moved the pair to Tacoma, Washington, which is where she met Johnny. In 1951, Eleanor and Johnny were married, but Ted was not pleased. He often threw huge temper tantrums out in public, sometimes even wetting himself. But beside that, Johnny decided to adopt him. Part of the reason why Ted didn't like Johnny was because Johnny was only middle class, so he couldn't afford to buy Ted the high-end things that he wanted, so they fought a lot. When Ted was older, he often antagonized Johnny and belittled his intelligence to the point that Johnny would hit him out of frustration. Though Ted loved Eleanor, their relationship was strained due to his illegitimacy. That was exasperated more when Eleanor gave birth to 4 more children with Johnny. Sorry. Computer freaked out. Though many people know Ted as having excellent people skills and charisma and just very charming, as a child, he severely lacked those skills. Sandy Holt, who grew up with Ted, was interviewed for Confessions with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes, and she said that Ted was often bullied for having a speech impediment and for not keeping up with his fellow Boy Scouts. As a result, he was very shy. He never played sports because he was not able to make any of the teams. However, he did love downhill skiing. He only went on one date in high school. Ted later explained, "It wasn't that I disliked women or afraid of them. It was just that I didn't seem to have an inkling of what to do about them." Because he was such a loner, Ted did okay in school. Not top of his class, but not bad either. He did make some friends and worked cutting lawns and delivering newspapers, and he did become the Methodist Youth Fellowship president, at the church his family attended. But with all of this, he still had his dark side. Sandy Holt, the woman who Ted went to school with, said that Ted loved scaring people. She talked about how he loved digging holes in the ground, putting spikes in the bottom, and covering the hole in vegetation. At least one girl fell in and hurt her leg. A fellow Boy Scout said that one time Ted came up behind him and hit him over the head with a stick. Ted also loved fictional detective stories that had gore-filled stories involving rape and murder. When he went back to Philadelphia to visit his grandparents, Ted stole his grandfather's porn magazines. In junior high, he would hide in the closets at the school and masturbate. When his classmates would catch him, they would douse him with water. Now, remember how I mentioned that Ted wanted very expensive things that his stepfather couldn't afford? Well, Ted started stealing the things that he wanted, especially ski equipment. He also forged ski tickets so he could go skiing for free every weekend. As a teenager, he attempted to steal a car, but was only given a warning as a punishment. And Ted had also become a peeping Tom, which many psychologists say is a precursor for sexual violence. Though Ted's first known victim wasn't killed until 1974, it is believed that he was responsible for the death of an 8-year-old girl in 1961. 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr went missing from her home in Tacoma the night of August 31st, 1961. Ted was just 14 years old at the time and lived just a few blocks away. It is believed that he was out peeping that night, saw Anne, and just couldn't resist. The front door of her house was left open, and a footprint was found outside her open bedroom window. Her family was home at the time, which also corresponds with Ted's killings as an adult. The police believe that Anne may have known the kidnapper who came in through her window and left through the front door. She may have met Ted while he was delivering newspapers or while visiting his uncle, who lived in the same neighborhood. However, even on his execution day, Ted has completely denied taking her. Despite all of this, Ted was only arrested twice for petty theft, and his criminal record was expunged when he turned 18. In 1965, Ted graduated from Woodrow Wilson High School and promptly went to the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma. There, he excelled academically, but was still socially awkward. He avoided social activities, rarely dated, and kept to himself. When later interviewed, Ted blames that awkwardness on the fact that many of his peers at the university were wealthy families. Because of this, in his sophomore year, he decided to transfer to the University of Washington. While he was still socially awkward in 1967, Ted met a woman who he had fallen madly in love with. She had everything that he had wanted: beauty, wealth, and sophistication. She also shared his love for skiing, so they spent many weekends at the slopes. Eventually, the couple became engaged, but he lied to her a lot. He wanted to impress her, so he told her he was working He wanted to impress her, so he never told her that he was working part-time as a grocery store bagger. He also told her he had a summer scholarship at Stanford University. Or he had won a summer scholarship, sorry. However, the stress of working, college, and a girlfriend were too much for Ted, so he dropped out in 1969 and began working various minimum wage jobs. One of those jobs was working at a national suicide hotline. He also began volunteering for Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign. He even worked as one of Rockefeller's delegates in the 1968 Republican National Convention in Miami, Florida. Due to his lack of ambition, Ted's girlfriend just had had enough. She left him and moved back to California to be with her parents. It was around this time that those around Ted began to notice his petty theft. Feeling depressed, he decided to travel to Colorado, Arkansas, Philadelphia. And while in Philadelphia, he enrolled for a semester at Temple University. In the fall of 1969, though, Ted returned to the University of Washington. It was this time that Ted had reinvented himself into the confident, charismatic man that he was known for. It was in 1969 that Ted met 24-year-old single mother Elizabeth Kendall. Liz had recently moved to Seattle after divorcing her husband, bringing her 2-year-old daughter Molly with her. Ted and Liz met one night while Liz was dancing with her girlfriends. Ted took her back to her house, where they slept next to each other but did not have any intercourse. When she awoke the next morning, Ted was in the kitchen making her and Molly breakfast. It was at that point that Liz began to fall madly in love with him. Despite all of the time that they spent together, every time Liz brought up marriage, Ted became apprehensive. Over the years, they began to spend less and less time together, and Liz began to suspect that Ted was cheating on her. But she stayed because she loved him and felt that if he was cheating on her, it was her fault, and that she had pushed him away. He taught Molly how to ride a bike, was always playing with her and her friends, and was just always there for her emotionally. But there were definitely some weird undertones. Molly recounted in an interview she gave for the documentary Ted Bundy Falling for a Killer that there was a time when her and Ted were playing hide and seek and Ted went to go hide. Molly found him under a blanket naked. When she asked why, he said that he could turn invisible, but he couldn't make his clothes that way. Out of fear that Liz would send Ted away, Molly didn't say anything. She basically convinced herself that Ted just got carried away. She knew he broke the rules often, and it was during that time that Ted had started the killings. On January 4th, 1974, Karen Epley was living in the University District on the UW campus when she was attacked and left for dead. Ted came into her home, took a part of her bed frame and smashed her skull with it. Using the same piece of the bed frame, he then sexually assaulted her. As a result, her bladder was completely split. When Ted was finished, he just left her. Karen remained there for 18 hours before she was found. Miraculously, though, she had survived. It is believed that she is his first victim in the series of gruesome murders and only one of a few women to ever survive. She was left with permanent brain damage, lost 50% of her hearing, 40% of her vision. She experiences constant tinnitus, which is the ringing in the ears, and for a period developed epilepsy. She unfortunately did not come forward with what happened to her until after Ted's death. On January 31, 1974, Linda Healy, a 21-year-old University of Washington student, disappeared from her home in the middle of the night while her roommates were sleeping. Linda was well known around campus for hosting the weekday ski report for the campus radio. Linda's roommate Karen Scavlim told authorities that when she had returned home that night, she had noted that Linda's door, which was across the hall in the basement from her, was closed, so she had assumed that Linda was sleeping. She remembered that as she came down the stairs to the basement, she had locked the door that led to the side of the house. Basically, it was just a random door that led outside. That was just kind of, the stairs were, you had stairs coming down one way, and then in a 90-degree angle, they came down the other way. And on that landing in between the two different sets of stairs was where the stairs went, or the door went, I'm sorry. But she remembered locking it on her way to bed. Karen awoke the next morning to Linda's alarm going off, but when Linda hadn't gotten up to turn it off, she went to see what was going on. Karen went to Linda's room only to find out that she wasn't in there and her bed was still made from the day before. She also noted that the side door was no longer locked, so she had assumed that Linda had just gone to work early and forgot to turn her alarm off. However, when Linda didn't show up to work, her friends became concerned, so they contacted the police. Initially, the police just blew it off, but they eventually sent an officer over to check it out. When the officer came and searched her room, they removed the bed sheets from her bed and found bloodstains. And in the closet, they found a nightgown covered in blood. On March 12, 1974, Ted abducted 19-year-old Donna Manson. She was an Evergreen State College student in Olympia, Washington. She was known for taking off periodically, did poorly in school, and smoked marijuana daily. Her roommate also said that she was obsessed with death, magic, and alchemy. Due to this, Donna wasn't reported missing for 6 days. On March 12th, she left her room at 7 p.m. to attend a jazz concert on the school campus. She was never seen again, but it is believed that some of the unidentified human remains found on Taylor Mountain on March 3rd, 1977, belonged to her. On April 17th, 1974, 18-year-old Susan Rancourt was attending... Sorry about that, my son came in to ask me a question. So on April 17th, 1974, 18-year-old Susan Rancourt, who attended Central Washington State College in Ellensburg, disappeared. She worked for the local police department, so her disappearance was taken very seriously. Susan was walking home from a student advisor meeting at the college library, but never made it back to her home. The Boy Scouts performed ground searches in hopes of finding her. Her brother even enlisted the help of a friend who owned a plane to perform a grid search, hoping to find her yellow ski jacket, but to no avail. There was a rumor going around that before Susan had gone missing, there was a man who had bandages on his arm asking women for help at the library. On May 6, 1974, 20-year-old Roberta Parks disappeared from the Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. She had gone out for a late-night stroll and never returned. Ted later admitted that he chose to go to Oregon to throw the police off of his trail. He claimed that he had killed and raped her at Taylor Mountain, just 25 miles southeast of Seattle. On June 1st, 1974, at 5:20 p.m. in Ellensburg, 22-year-old sorority sister Brenda Ball disappeared. Just before her disappearance, she was seen talking to a man with a cast on his leg, asking for help with getting his car started. Just 2 hours before Brenda's disappearance, her sorority sister Phyllis Armstrong came home to find a man on crutches outside the sorority house with a cast on his leg and carrying a gas can. He asked her for help getting his car started, and wanting to help, Phyllis followed him. He led her back to his tan Volkswagen Bug, but while trying to get it started, she got a very bad feeling and just booked it home. On June 11th, 1974, 18-year-old Georgianne Hawkins was a student at UW. She had gone to a house party, but before stopping at her boyfriend's dorm at 12:30 a.m. to say goodnight and borrow some Spanish notes before heading back to her sorority house just 6 houses away to study for finals. The street was packed with partying college students, and yet she never made it home. Ted later admitted how trusting Georgianne was. He had a cast on his leg and had asked her for help with his briefcase. When they got to his car, he hit her over the head before driving to Taylor Mountain, where he strangled her and buried her body. On July 14th, Ted went to Lake Sammamish, which was occupied with around 40,000 people. Putting his arm in a sling, he approached 23-year-old Janice Ott and then later 19-year-old Denise Naslund. He asked both of them to help him with putting his catamaran on top of his VW Bug, and that was the last anyone saw the girls. Due to the fact that there were 40,000 people at the lake, there was also heavy police presence. Witnesses were able to provide a description of Ted, and they remember him introducing himself as Ted. At this point, a sketch of Ted was released to the public, and those who knew him were beginning to ask questions. One of his professors at UW even went to the police, but they ruled him out because he was such a nice guy. Liz also began to wonder. When it was released that the man who was seen with Janice and Denise was on crutches, Liz remembered seeing crutches and plaster of Paris in Ted's room. The only reason why she quit panicking was she ended up calling the police herself. The car that Ted was seen driving at Lake Sammamish was reported as being bronze, but the car that Ted drove was a dull tan. Police confirmed that the car was indeed bronze and put her fears to rest. In September of 1974, grouse hunters in Issaquah found the skull of Janice Ott. They immediately called the police, who then found the bodies of Georgianne Hawkins and Denise Naslund. This area also happened to be just 2 miles away from where Janice Ott and Denise Naslund had disappeared. By late September, Ted moved to Utah after being accepted to the University of Utah Law School. He and Liz remained together at this time, but she and her daughter Molly remained in Seattle. On October 2nd, 1974, 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox disappeared from Holiday, Utah. She was last seen riding in a Volkswagen Bug. Unfortunately, her body was never found. On October 18th, 1974, 17-year-old Melissa Smith went missing in Midvale, Utah. The daughter of a Midvale police chief, she was known for being very cautious. She had plans to attend a sleepover that night, but ended up walking to a local pizza parlor to console a friend who had just gotten into a fight with her boyfriend. She left the pizza parlor to return home and get her overnight bag, but never made it home. She was found 9 days later, miles away from her small town, severely beaten, raped, and sodomized. After hearing about this murder, Liz couldn't get over the coincidence that these murders seemed to be following Ted. So she called the King County Police to speak with them. When she said that she thought it could be her boyfriend Ted committing the murders, they immediately asked if she meant Theodore Robert Bundy. After confirming that he indeed was her boyfriend, she was asked to meet with a police officer with her photo albums. However, after the police took her photos, they never called her back. After a period of time, she ended up calling them, and originally the police officer didn't remember speaking with her, but after some reminding, the officer said that he showed the photos to the witnesses of Janice Ott and Denise Naslund, and they said that Ted was not the man who took the woman, that he was too old to be the suspect, and then the matter was dropped. On October 31st, 1974, 17-year-old Leahy, Utah resident Laura Amy had gone to a local cafe, but became bored with the festivities. She left it around midnight to go to a local park, but was never seen again. Laura was found a month later on a riverbank in the Wasatch Mountains. She was nude and beaten beyond recognition. Ted had raped, strangled, and beaten her with a crowbar. On November 8, 1974, 18-year-old Carol DeRanche left for a shopping mall from her home in Salt Lake City, Utah, at about 6:30 p.m. While in Walden Books, a handsome man that was well-dressed approached her and introduced himself as a police officer and asked her what kind of car she was driving. When she told him, he told her that someone had broken into her car and she needed to come out and see if anything was missing or damaged. As they walked into the rainy weather, she remembered smelling alcohol in his breath, so she asked to see his ID. He just laughed it off, and, you know, she was just a kid at the time, so she just felt stupid for asking and just pushed her uneasy feeling aside. When they got to Carol's car and saw nothing was missing, he informed her that she would have to come with him to headquarters and led her to a back door of what she thought was the headquarters, but it later learned it was just a laundromat. He looked inside and said that the man must have been taken to the station, so she should come with him to identify the man and led her to his tan Volkswagen Bug. It was when she was in the car and they were going in the opposite direction of the police station that Carol knew she was in danger. As he was speeding down the road, he was yelling at her to put on her seatbelt, and she refused, obviously. So he pulled over on the side of the road and pulled out a pair of handcuffs and a gun. He told her that to do as he said or he would kill her, but she fought tooth and nail. He was able to put the handcuffs on, but in the struggle, he put them on the same arm. She was able to get out of the car, but he followed and shoved her against it. The one thing that will always stick with me was this was during a time when women were being told that if a man is trying to rape you, do not fight back because it will just anger the man and could lead to him killing you. She remembered thinking to herself, though, that this man was going to kill her anyway, so she was going to go down fighting. Out of sheer adrenaline, she was able to push him away right as a car driven by an elderly couple was driving by. She was able to get them to stop and immediately jumped into the car, telling them that he was trying to kill her. At 10 p.m. that same night, 17-year-old Debbie Kent from Bountiful, Utah, was visiting a play with her parents at her high school. They needed to pick up her brother from a local skating rink, so she said that she would just go and get him. When the play was over and the parking lot was empty, that was when the parents realized that her car was still parked in the space that they had left it when they arrived, meaning that Debbie hadn't taken the car. Shortly before Debbie went missing, however, faculty advisor Raylan Shepard noticed a man in the hallway outside the auditorium. She said that he looked extremely out of place due to his expensive clothing. He approached her, asking if she could come outside and identify a car in the parking lot. Raylan said that his eye contact is what made her feel uncomfortable. She remembered telling him that if he needed help, she could go get some men to assist him, which he vehemently denied before walking away. She went backstage to let the principal know, but when he went and searched, he couldn't find the man. However, that was because he was in the auditorium. She remembered seeing Debbie get out of her seat and the man following her out. She lives with that guilt every single day that she could have stopped Debbie's disappearance. On January 12, 1975, 23-year-old Karen Campbell disappeared while on vacation in Aspen, Colorado with her fiancé and his two children. While sitting in the lobby of the inn that they were staying at, Karen remembered a magazine she was reading that she left in the room, so she got up to go grab it. That was the last time she was seen was at the elevator. Karen was found February 18th, a little over a month later, in a snowbank off of Owl Creek Road, not far from the inn that she was staying at. She was nude, beaten, and cut, and it's highly suspected that she had been raped. On March 1st, 1975, the bodies of Linda Healy, Susan Rancourt, and Roberta Parks were found on Taylor Mountain near Issaquah, Washington, close to where the remains of Janice Ott, Denise Nasland, and George Ann Hawkins were found. At the time, Liz was heavily listening to the news at this point. When she heard about Carol DeRanche's abduction by a man named Ted in a tan VW Bug, her worst thoughts were confirmed. At the urging of her bishop, Liz called the Salt Lake City Police Department to speak with the officer, but once again, they assured her that they had already looked into him and he wasn't their guy. On April 6th, 1975, 25-year-old Denise Olverson of Grand Junction, Colorado, had gotten on her bike to head to her parents' house after a fight with her husband. When she didn't return the next day, her husband called her parents, but they didn't even know that Denise was coming and informed him that she had never shown up. The police were called, who then searched the area around the route that she likely would have taken. Under a viaduct near a railroad bridge, they found her bike and sandals, but her body has never been found. On April 15th, 1975, 18-year-old Melanie Cooley of Nederland, Colorado, left her high school, never to be seen again. County workers found her body on April 23rd. She was bludgeoned with her hands tied together and a dirty pillowcase was still wrapped around her neck. On April 16, 1975, a police officer working in a suburb near Salt Lake City, Utah, noticed an unusual car parked outside the house of a young girl whose parents the police knew were out of town. The car happened to be a tan Volkswagen Bug that the police recognized from Carol DeRanche's abduction. After a pursuit, the police were able to pull that car over. Inside was Ted, as well as handcuffs, a ski mask, pantyhose with holes cut out for a nose and eyes, an ice pick, rope, and garbage bags. At this point, everything clicked into place. Back in Seattle, the King County Police finally sat down with Liz to seriously talk about Ted. The Salt Lake City Police also got a hold of Carol DeRanche to see if she could identify him as the man who abducted her almost a year earlier. She drove down and picked him from a lineup. Immediately, due to the way he carried himself and his mannerisms, she knew Ted was the guy. On October 2nd, 1975, police had enough evidence to officially arrest him. While in prison, Ted sent Liz letters often, denying everything and telling her how much he loved her. Liz remained with Ted while working as a police informant. Eventually, Eleanor and Johnny were able to make Ted's bail. At this point, Ted had become sort of a celebrity, with many ladies refusing to believe that he was capable of such heinous crimes. After his release, he returned to Seattle, showed up at Liz's house, and at that point, she basically allowed him to live with her, thinking that she had been wrong about everything. On February 23rd, 1976, Ted began trial for the abduction of Carol DeRanche. Carol was questioned for hours by Ted's attorneys, trying to get her to admit that she didn't know who her abductor was and that she didn't actually see him. Carol even said during her interview for the documentary, Ted Bundy Falling for a Killer, that women who had lived in her neighborhood and were at his trial would come up to her and ask her the very same questions. Ted was convicted for Carol DeRanche's attempted kidnapping on March 1st, 1967. He was charged with aggravated kidnapping and sentenced to 1 to 15 years in a Utah state prison. When searching Ted's apartment, the police found credit card receipts for gas in the same town and day that Karen Campbell had gone missing. In October of 1976, investigators believed that they had enough evidence to convict Ted with the rape and murder of Karen Campbell. On January 29, 1977, Ted was extradited to Colorado to await trial for his conviction of Karen's death. The county jail, however, was way more relaxed than the state prison he was previously at. For the case of Karen's death, Ted decided he wanted to represent himself. This meant that he had use of the Aspen Courthouse Library. On January 7th, 1977, while using this library, Ted jumped from a second-story window and escaped. After spending a night in the rain, he came across a cabin in the woods where he spent 8 days. On the ninth day, he walked back to Aspen and attempted to steal a car before he was quickly taken into custody. On December 20th, 1977, about 6 months later, Ted was being held at the Garfield County Jail, where he ripped out a light fixture out of the ceiling and created a 12-inch by 12-inch hole. He was able to maneuver himself through this hole and escaped for a second time. Because he did this at night, his escape wasn't found until the next day, which gave him enough of a head start to hop on a flight to Chicago and from there to Tallahassee, Florida. While in Florida, Ted went by the alias Chris Hagen, supporting himself with petty theft. On January 24th, 1978, Ted unfortunately killed again. This time he hit a sorority at the Florida State University. 21-year-old Karen Chandler had just gotten home from having dinner with her family a little before midnight, planning on working on a sewing project. However, Ted was there and beat her over the head. She was left with broken teeth, jaw, and skull fractures and cuts. Ted fled the house, but the girls had no idea that Karen was not the first victim. 20-year-old Kathy Kleiner was also attacked. Ted attacked her in her sleep. He left her with lacerations and puncture wounds to the face. Her jaw was broken in 3 places and hanging by only one hinge. She had broken teeth and really bad whiplash. She lived, but required many surgeries to repair these wounds. 20-year-old Lisa Levy had returned from a disco party at about 10:30 p.m. She was also attacked in her sleep. Unfortunately, she died on the way to the hospital. Her nipple was almost completely bitten off. Her collarbone was broken. She was strangled. There were two bite marks on her buttocks and had a hairspray bottle jammed into her vagina. 21-year-old Margaret Bowman went to bed at 2:30. When she was found, she was still laying on her stomach in her bed. Her skull had been so shattered that the police could barely distinguish each of the wounds. She was strangled with a piece of nylon so hard that her neck was nearly broken. After Ted fled from the Chi Omega house, he went to the home of Cheryl Thomas just 6 blocks away. At about 4 a.m., Cheryl awoke to a crash coming from the kitchen, but just assumed it was her kitten, so she went back to sleep. A few minutes later, Cheryl's neighbors, who shared a wall with her, woke up to a weird hammering that was so hard it was shaking their beds. The girls had a safety system. If they knew that each of them were home, if one of them called, the other had to answer, no matter what time of day it was, no matter what they were doing. So the neighbor called, and when Cheryl didn't answer the phone, they immediately called the police. However, they didn't know about what had happened at the Chi Omega house, so they were shocked when police showed up just 4 minutes later. Unfortunately, Ted got away again. Inside the apartment, Cheryl was found whimpering in bed, laying diagonal. She had been severely beaten, leaving her with 5 skull fractures, permanent hearing loss in her left ear, and a dislocated shoulder. Her jaw was broken and had severe nerve damage that left her with permanent equilibrium problems. She spent a full month in the hospital recovering. On January 9th, 1978, after stealing a university Volkswagen Bug, Ted drove 106 miles to Lake City, Florida, where he found his last victim. I'm really sorry for this, guys. While running between the buildings of her junior high school, 12-year-old Kimberly Leach was taken. Witnesses said that they saw her talking to a very angry man while Kimberly was crying. The witnesses said that they had assumed that Ted was just an angry father, so they just let it be. When she hadn't returned from her afternoon classes, the school called her parents to make sure she was okay. Kimberly was not a person who skipped school, so her parents were immediately concerned. On April 7th, 1978, Kimberly's badly decomposed body was found in a pig pen. There were obvious signs of sexual assault and strangulation, but no signs of head trauma. Kimberly at the time was the same age as Liz's daughter, Molly. On February 15th, 1978, Pensacola police officer David Lee was on patrol. At about 1:30 a.m., he noticed an orange Volkswagen Bug pulling out of an alleyway without its headlights on. While pulling the car over, Lee ran the plates, only to find that the car had been stolen. He immediately pulled the man from the vehicle, attempting to detain him on the ground. The man fought back, kicking Lee's feet from underneath him and placing a handcuff on the officer's wrist. The man took off running, and a chase ensued. Thinking that he saw a gun, Lee pulled out his service weapon and fired. Though the bullet didn't hit the man, he collapsed to the ground. In the midst of Lee trying to cuff him, Ted fought the officer for Lee's weapon, so Lee pistol whipped him. You can actually see the bruise in his mugshot. This subdued him enough for Lee to arrest him. Initially, Ted would not give any information to officers. The only name that they could go off of was the name on his driver's license, Kenneth Meisner. When he had his first appearance in court for the stolen vehicle and assault on a police officer, the judge asked him flat out, "Is your name Kenneth Meisner?" Ted simply responded, "No, sir," crossed his arms, and refused to give his real name. Back at the station, Ted spoke to his court-appointed attorney and told them that he would give them the information they wanted, only if he could make some phone calls first. They allowed him 2 hours to make these calls. He immediately called Liz. He basically alluded that he had committed the crimes he was accused of without actually saying that he did them. He told her that he was like an alcoholic, that if he goes too long without the things he needs, he can't control himself. He also told her that he would be confessing to the crimes the next day. Unfortunately, as we all know, he didn't. After his indictment for the Chi Omega murders, Ted realized that the media could be his friend. He could use the media to sort of humanize himself and sway the public's opinion about him. In June of 1979, Ted's trial for the Chi Omega murders began. Ted pled not guilty to all crimes and once again chose to defend himself. The press were in every single one of Ted's court hearings, and Ted really did present him as an actual lawyer, or present himself. So much so that after his sentencing, the judge told him, "Son, it has been an honor having you in here. You could have gone so far, and I would have loved having you in my courtroom, working in my courtroom." It was during these hearings that women all over the country began to swoon for him. Tons of women who were at the court hearings were interviewed, many saying how it must have been so hard for him to be accused of such horrible crimes. One woman, Carol Ann Boone, was one such woman. Carol had known Ted for years. They worked together at the suicide hotline and had developed feelings for each other at that time. But Carol had been married when they worked together, so she had wanted things to stay strictly platonic. When her and her husband got divorced, Carol was at every single one of Ted's court hearings, both in Florida and Colorado. She often visited him in jail and was often very outspoken about Ted's innocence, even with autopsy and crime scene photos. One piece of evidence that was 100% incriminating was his dental marks. While he was in jail during trial, the guards were able to convince Ted to see a dentist under the guise of needing a routine cleaning. The dentist was able to trick Ted into giving a dental impression that was then handed over to the coroner who was working on Lisa Levy. The coroner was able to compare his dental impressions to the two bite marks that were left on Lisa's backside. On July 30th, 1979, Ted was found guilty and sentenced to 7 crimes, 2 counts of assault and burglary, 3 counts of attempted murder of Karen Chandler, Kathy Kleiner, and Cheryl Thomas, and 2 counts of murder of Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy. On February 9th, 1970, Ted was found guilty of the murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. It was during his trial for Kimberly that, I forgot to put it in my notes. Basically, with the 7 crimes that he was guilty and sentenced to, he was sentenced to 2 counts of the death penalty via electric chair. Anyways, on February 9th, 1980, Ted was found guilty for the murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach. It was during his trial for Kimberly that Ted took advantage of a loophole in Florida law. If a marriage proposal was done in the presence of a judge, it was considered a legal marriage. While he had Carol on the stand as a character witness, he proposed. Makes me so sick. That same day, he was sentenced for the death of Kimberly's murder. Sentenced to death for Kimberly's murder. Turned her fire. Oh my gosh, it makes me so angry. He turned her death into a freaking charade. After his conviction for Kimberly's death, Ted had a total of 9 different appeals to overturn his death sentence. This was during a time that people, mainly college students, were trying to abolish the death penalty in Florida. Carol was right there with them trying to spare Ted's life. She very much believed that he was wrongfully convicted, that she was going to be able to free Ted and that they were going to have a family together. Somehow they were able to bribe guards to allow them to have conjugal visits, resulting in them conceiving a child. She also often smuggled drugs into the jail for him, drugs and money. On October 24th, 1981, Carol gave birth to their daughter Rosa Bundy. On July 21st, 1986, just one day before Ted was scheduled to be executed, he was granted a stay of execution due to another appeal. It was during this time that Carol began to feel defeated. Likely due to the stress of it all, she filed for divorce and took her two children, Jamie from a previous marriage and Rosa, back and moved back to Washington State. On January 31st, 1989, On January 31st, 1989, just 3 days before his execution, Ted called Carol to let her know, or to ask her if he should tell the authorities where the rest of the bodies were located. He thought that this would be able to convince the governor to pardon his execution and move him to life in prison because he was finally cooperating. It was also the first time that Ted had admitted that he was, in fact, the man who had committed all of those horrible crimes. Ted admitted to all of the murders in the Seattle, Colorado, and Utah area, as well as other unsolved crimes. He talked of picking up hitchhikers, how he would knock them out so they wouldn't talk to him, before taking them into the woods to rape and murder them. Some of his murders even took place before his Seattle rampage. On June 23, 1966, 20-year-olds Lonnie Trumbell and Lisa Wick from Seattle, Washington, were roommates. Their other roommate had come home very late to find the front door unlocked and a light on, which was very unusual for the girls. When she called inside to see what was going on and got no answer, she went to find the girls. Both girls were found with blood soaking their pillows and splattered on the walls. Both girls had been brutally beaten, but were not sexually assaulted. Lonnie Trumbell survived, likely due to the curlers that she had worn to bed, but did require major surgery to relieve the pressure on her brain due to her many skull fractures. On July 19th, 1971, 24-year-old schoolteacher Rita Curran was working that summer as a housekeeper at a local hotel next to an unwed mother's home, just like the one that Ted's mother gave birth in, in Burlington, Vermont. That night, she had returned home at about 10 p.m. from a rehearsal with her barbershop quartet. At about 11:30, her roommate left with a friend, and when they returned home, she had assumed that Rita had gone to bed. But when she didn't leave her room the following morning, the friend went to check on her. Rita was found in bed, strangled, raped, and brutally beaten. On July 29th, 1973, 17-year-old Rita Jolly went missing from West Lynn, Oregon. Rita left her residence on Horton Road in West Lynn at 7:15 p.m. to go for a walk. She never returned. She was last seen between 8:30 and 9 p.m. that day walking uphill on Sunset Avenue. Her body, unfortunately, was never found. On August 20th, 1973, 24-year-old Vicki Holler of Eugene, Oregon, left work at the Bon Marché at about 5 p.m. She had gone home to prepare for a neighborhood party with one of her roommates, but when she never showed up, the friend left a note stating she was going without her. All of her clothes and belongings were still in the house, and her last paycheck was never picked up. She did have a habit of picking up hitchhikers. Her body, car, and purse have never been found. On March 15, 1975, 25-year-old ski instructor Julie Cunningham of Vail, Colorado, left her home for a local tavern. She was supposed to meet her roommate, but never arrived. On May 6, 1975, 12-year-old... I hate the murders that involve children. 12-year-old Lynette Culver of Pocatello, Idaho, left her junior high school for lunch, never to be seen again. Bundy admitted that he kidnapped her, drowned her in the bathtub of his motel before disposing of her body in the Snake River, and unfortunately her body was never found. On July 4th, 1975, 23-year-old Nancy Baird disappeared from the gas station she worked at in Layton, Utah. Her body was never found. On June 27th, 1975, 15-year-old Susan Curtis of Bountiful, Utah, was attending a Bountiful Orchard Youth Conference and in at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, for 2 days. After the conference on the first day, she left to walk the quarter mile to her dorm, but never showed up. Ted claimed to have buried her body on the side of a highway, but her body was never found. On January 20, oh, I knew I had the date wrong. It was 21st, not the 31st of January, when he confessed all of the crimes. Sorry. Easy typo to make. On January 24th, 1989, dozens of people flocked to the Florida State Prison to celebrate Ted's execution. Witnesses, lawyers, and family members of both Ted and the victims showed up to the prison at 5 a.m. for a buffet-style breakfast leading up to his 7 a.m. execution. The only glimmer of fear that Ted ever showed was only momentary when the guards led him to the execution chamber and he saw the electric chair for the first time. However, he quickly regained his composure. His last words were, "Give my love to my family and friends," before the guards covered his face. One of his attorneys, at the request of Ted, called Liz after the execution to tell her that he loved her and Molly. Ted's younger brother, Rich, who was also affected in an intense way. He was about 12 years old when Ted started his spree in Seattle. Ted often took him camping and on family trips with him, Liz, and Molly. But he now has said that any happiness he felt during those times that he was with Ted mean nothing to him because so many others were feeling such sadness at the same time. Now, as an adult, he struggles with severe depression to the point that he sometimes doesn't leave his camper for days at a time. Molly and Liz both took up drinking for a period of time to cope with their grief. At the passing of Ted, not at the passing of Ted, but for their grief for the families of all the women and girls that he murdered. A lot of the it took a lot of work to get to where they are now. They know just how close they were to becoming one of Ted's victims. All of his victims had long brown hair parted down the middle and were around the same age as them. Liz and Molly also both had long brown hair that was parted down the middle. Liz will always have the thought, were they murdered because they look like me? Or did Ted like me because I looked like his victims? In 2018, Ted's ex-wife, Carol Ann Boone, passed away in a nursing home in Washington State. Not much is known about Ted's daughter, Rosa. It is believed that she changed her name to lose her ties to Ted, which I don't blame her at all. Ted confessed to 30 murders 3 days before his execution. The FBI have only been able to identify 20 of these women. It is believed that he killed many more, and it's estimated that his body count could likely be up into the triple digits. So that's that. That's Ted Bundy, everyone. It was a hard one for me, both time-wise, because there's so much information that I had to go through, but also emotionally. It's really hard when you're going through all of that stuff and happening to read all of the information of all of the people that he killed. And as a parent, when it comes to children, it's especially hard for me to read that type of information, let alone write it and talk about it. And my heart absolutely breaks for all of the families and all of the women that lost their lives to him. One thing that really sticks with me is before all of this, I couldn't help but think, how did Ted amass such a huge fan base? How did so many women fall for his ways, his charming ways? And just listening to all of the interviews in Ted Bundy falling for a killer, it made it a lot easier for me to see because he was able to completely change himself. And that was the scary thing for all of these women. Not a single one of them truly felt scared. You know, when he was talking, the day that he finally admitted to the murders, you know, 3 days before his execution, He sat down with a paralegal who was working for him, you know, trying to, it was his appeals lawyer is what it was, she was. And the entire time she never feared for him or anything, but the minute he started talking about what he had done, she said it was like everything about him just became dark and he completely changed. And it was in that moment that she became scared. Like, she truly was scared of him. And she actually quit practicing law because of it. And it really makes you realize that you never truly know anybody. You don't truly know who a person is. You think you do, but you truly don't. And I think that's why Ted Bundy scares me so much and why I felt the need to cover it this week, cover his case. But yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it. Not enjoyed it. I'm sorry, that's not a good word. I'm at a lack of words, honestly. But yeah, that's that. I hope you all are staying safe. And like I said at the beginning of the episode, you know, practicing good social distancing and hand washing. And please keep you and your family safe. You know, we're thinking about you. We were in quarantine for a possible case of coronavirus here in our household. And thankfully, we just got the test results back. And it was just a really nasty cold. But it's scary out there, guys. So make sure you're checking in on the people in your life who are elderly and immune compromised and those who can't leave their home to get the supplies that they need. This is a time where we all need to come together as a community and take care of our most vulnerable. But I hope you all have a wonderful week and we'll hear from you again.